Procrastination makes you feel like you have no self-control, right? When you struggle with procrastination, you just can't seem to get yourself to focus on it. You feel and you have lost control over yourself. However, when you 5-4-3-2-1 and assert yourself and you just get started, just for 5 minutes, I'm not asking you to finish it. I'm not asking you to spend, just get started, please. You are taking control of the moment and you are taking control of your life. Daniela wrote, she said, you know, my relationship with myself has improved. I trust myself more. I feel empowered and capable. It has become my mantra, do something now. As I explained throughout this book, exerting effort, 5-4-3-2-1, switches the gears in your mind and allows the prefrontal cortex to help you get started. Now, each time you use the rule, it's going to get easier and easier to stop procrastinating and just start. Remember in the part one, I talked about acts of bravery. And I talked about how when your instincts fire up, you're going to be alone. And I mentioned the woman Sai in China, who's got a new business, and how she's thinking about calling her friends. And she starts to get worried and feel discouraged. Well, now she's writing, and she says, Dear Mel, I'm writing to say thank you about the 5-second rule. I watched it a few months ago, and after that, I keep telling myself, just make the call. Reply to the email. Finish the stupid job. I don't like it, but it helps me get what I want. I am glad that I have done a huge project after getting this habit. Thank you so much for this amazing tool. You know, even though she doesn't feel like doing it, right? You know, she just said, I don't feel like doing it. But she's completed a huge project with this mindset. And the truth is, it's true. If you just get started, if you just push yourself, if you understand procrastination, which you do now, it's just stress. You procrastinate because you're stressed. So give yourself a friggin' break. Remind yourself that in the future, you're not going to care about this moment. And then get started. That's it. In Scott's case, he's going to use the rule 5-4-3-2-1. He's going to work for just a short period of time. And then he's going to realize, holy cow, wow, the source of procrastination, it was financial stress. And, you know, here's the thing. When he finds himself getting off track again, because he's got a dissertation to write. I'm sure he's going to feel stressed again. 5-4-3-2-1. That's a way to take control. The rule is going to make it easier for you to just get going. It's going to make it easy for you to interrupt when you get off track. Andre also used the rule to push past procrastination and act on his goals. Now, Andre's only 16 years old. I mean, the rule is so simple. You can share this with your kids, with your nieces, with your nephews, with anybody. He's already learning how to beat procrastination. He's actually starting to write a book. He said that he's always had excuses, that he wasn't ready. Let me read his email to you. Andre writes, I began to rely on an urge to act on my ideas, which led me to my involvement in BZ Change, a club with a focus in community service, which I am now president of. I also took action in reaching out to colleges and acting on my immediate academic goals. Many of my recent achievements were possible because I chose to engage in that idea within 5 seconds of my impulse. My objective now is to write a book, an impulse I had never taken the time to act on because I always had an excuse. I wasn't ready. I was too busy. I'm not smart enough. This rule helped me get past those excuses by taking the initiative to simply write down my goal and build on it. Every time I saw that sticky note about focusing my creativity on writing a book, I took a step, I tried something, it changed my life. How awesome is that? Andre shows us that at any age and with any goal, we have the power to own ourselves, to look inside, to take a step, to try something and change your life. The reason why just getting started is so important is because you'll also be tapping into what researchers call the progress principle, which describes the phenomenon that forward progress of any kind, including small wins, has to boost our mood and increase our happiness and our productivity levels. So the progress principle is a fringe benefit of just getting started. And on top of that, once you start a project, guess what? you're going to have triggered a mechanism in your brain to cue you to keep at it. Now, I mentioned earlier that researchers have found out that the brain remembers unfinished tasks better than finished ones. So once you start, your mind's going to keep nudging you to finish. I also told you that my snooze button habit, remember how I said it was a form of procrastination? Well, now I understand why. It gave me a momentary relief from the larger stress in my life. That's why I hit the snooze button. I was stressed about my life. The snooze button was a way to relieve that stress. Now, when I reflect back, I see now that I broke the habit by creating a starting ritual, the 5-second rule. The snooze button habit got replaced with the positive new habit. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then standing up and starting the day. So in sum, here's how you can most effectively use the 5-second rule to beat procrastination. Use it to make yourself start. Start small. Attack what you've been avoiding for just 15 minutes at a time. Then give yourself a break. Watch a few cat videos. And for crying out loud, could you please stop beating yourself up for blowing things off? You're only human. All this stuff, it's common sense. I know. I know. But my hope is that when you understand the science behind it, you hear that there's research that supports why these simple steps work, that you will feel empowered to apply them in your life. What you're learning over and over in this book, and what I learned over the last 7 years using the rule, is that unless you beat the feelings, the stresses that trigger your bad habits, and you learn how to push yourself to just get started, you're never going to change. But the good news is, if you do stop listening to your feelings, you've got everything you need to make any change you want. Next, we're going to turn to part 4 of the book and how courage changes your mind. In this book, you're going to learn how to become the happiest person you know. The next 3 chapters will walk through the step-by-step approach to how you can use the 5-second rule in combination with some recent research-based strategies to beat fear, to stop worrying, to manage and even cure anxiety, and absolutely change how you think. Now, if you've seen me on TV as a commentator for CNN or read my columns in Success Magazine, it's really easy to assume that I was born with the confidence of a warrior. That assumption only gets strengthened when you watch my YouTube videos or my TED Talk or experience an event where I'm speaking live on stage. Yeah, I'm confident now, but I was not born that way. For most of my adult life, I was a loudmouth. I was extroverted, but I was plagued by deep insecurity. Confidence is a skill that I've built over the years by practicing acts of everyday courage. What a lot of people don't know about me is that I've suffered from anxiety for more than 25 years. I had debilitating postpartum depression when our first daughter Sawyer was born, and I couldn't be left alone with her for the first 2 months. I've taken Zoloft to control my panic attacks for nearly 2 decades. The struggle with my thoughts has been real, and at times, terrifying. When I first discovered the rule, I used it to change my behavior. The rule worked wonders, and as acting with courage every day became second nature, my confidence grew stronger. However, the anxiety never fully disappeared, despite how confident I had become. It was always there, simmering beneath the surface. I focused on learning to live with it, manage it, and make sure that it didn't boil over into full-blown panic attacks. About 4 years ago, I started to wonder if I could use the 5-second rule to change more than my physical behavior. I wondered if I could change my thoughts. I had seen the effects that it had on other habits, so why not try to break the mental habit of anxiety, panic, and fear? I mean, they're patterns, just like nail biting or any other habit, just patterns that you repeat. They're just habits. So I started using the rule to change the way that my mind worked. I began by using the rule to break the habit of worrying. As I mastered that skill, I used the rule to control my anxiety and beat my fear of flying. That worked too. As I write this sentence, I can tell you, I've cured myself of anxiety. I haven't taken Zoloft in years, and I'm panic attack free. I no longer have a habit of worrying, and my fear of flying gone. Learning to take control of my mind, direct my thoughts, and dismantle fear has been the single greatest thing I have ever done to improve the quality of my life. I almost never feel worried. And the rare times that I do, I just 5-4-3-2-1 and I direct my mind toward the solutions rather than worrying about the problems. I've transformed my mind using the rule, and I'm the happiest and most optimistic that I've ever been. And I think that's because my mind is working for me instead of constantly working against me. Now it's your turn. How to learn the rule to do this remarkable mental transformation. First, you're going to learn how to break the addiction to worrying and negative self-talk using the 5-second rule, the science of habits, and the power of gratitude. Second, you'll dive into the subjects of anxiety and panic. You're going to learn what it is and what it isn't, and I'm going to give you a step-by-step method for how you can interrupt, reframe, and eventually eliminate anxiety from your life. Finally, you're going to learn a proven strategy for how you can beat any fear. Using my fear of flying as an example, you'll learn how to use the rule with anchor thoughts to prevent fear from taking over your mind. Everything you're about to learn is so simple, so powerful, that you can even teach it to your kids. Chapter 12, Stop Worrying. More than any other change, ending your habit of worrying will create the single biggest positive impact in your life. Believe it or not, you were taught to worry. As a kid, you heard your parents worrying constantly. Hey, be careful. Wear a hat or you'll catch a cold. Don't slip on the ice. Don't sit so close to the TV. As adults, we spend way too much time and energy worrying about things that we can't control or that could go wrong. And when you get to be near the end of your life, you'll wish you hadn't. Dr. Carl Pillamer is a professor of human development at Cornell University, and he's also the founder of something called the Legacy Project. You can Google it. He's met with more than 1,200 senior citizens that are living in nursing homes for one reason. He wanted to discuss the meaning of life. Now, in the middle of doing the project, he was shocked to learn that most people near the end of their lives had the exact same regret. The exact same one. I wish I hadn't spent so much of my lifetime worrying. Their advice was devastatingly simple and direct. Worrying is an enormous waste of your precious and limited lifetime. Now here's what's exciting. You can stop worrying. And the 5-second rule will teach you how. You see, worrying is a default setting that your mind goes to when you aren't paying attention. The key is catching yourself when you drift into worry and then regaining mental control by using the rule. I'm going to give you an example because it happens all day long to you. My husband recently got his motorcycle license and he just bought a small used motorcycle. Yesterday, I was sitting inside the house and I noticed him on the bike pulling out of the driveway. As he drove down the road, I noticed my mind immediately drifted into worry. I started to wonder whether or not he would get hit by a car. I wondered if he would become a statistic. And I started worrying that, I'm going to get a phone call from the police telling me he's been in an accident. The worry, it literally hijacked my mind within 5 seconds. It was that fast. And you know what? My worrying, it's not going to keep him safe, and it certainly is not going to prevent an accident. I was standing in our house, and he was out on the bike. What happens with worry is that the worrying kills me. It doesn't kill Chris. You know, as one 83-year-old in the study said, my worrying's not going to solve a thing. It just put me on edge for the entire time that Chris was out riding his motorcycle. And you know what that does? It doesn't protect him. It robs me of enjoying my life. Now, as soon as I catch myself worrying, I now use the 5-second rule, 5-4-3-2-1, and then I force myself to think about something more positive, like the thought of him smiling as he drives down the road. Now, here's the funny thing. Chris, my husband, he is a humongous cyclist. I think I've told you earlier in the book that he has done a half Ironman. He also is the race director for the triathlon in our hometown. I mean, he is out on his bike any nice day. The guy is out riding 50, 60 miles, constantly training. And he's always by himself. Now, what's interesting is I never worry about that, ever. I don't know why. My mind just never kind of drifts there. But here I was, standing in my office, He's driving the motorcycle 10 miles an hour down our road because he's trying to teach himself how to shift the gears. There are more turkeys on our road than actual cars. The chances of him getting hit, zero. Now, the thing, though, is that worrying takes over when you're not even paying attention. It happened the other day, again. Our daughters, they were returning home from a service trip in Peru, and throughout the day, I just caught my mind. Drift. I would be sitting there at my desk, I'd be reading an email, and all of a sudden, I would start thinking about a plane crash. I'd be thinking about a missed flight. I'd be thinking about them falling off the cliff in the Andes. Be thinking about a bus going back and forth on a switchback and tumbling off of lost bags of the girls being kidnapped at the airport. It was ridiculous. The girls were fine. And without the rule, I would have ruined my day. Here they were flying home from Peru, having just volunteered for a month, and I was suffering at my desk. But every time I caught myself drifting to a bad thought, I would say to myself, not doing that, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I would point to a thought that would make me smile. And the one that I kept picking is them walking into the house, dropping their luggage, talking a million miles an hour all about their trip. So my mind would drift to a plane crash. I'd go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I'd think about them in the kitchen. My mind would drift to one of them falling off a cliff in the Andes, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And my mind would go to them talking in the kitchen. Because here's the thing. If they're standing in the kitchen telling me about the trip, they obviously made it home, didn't they? And that thought then teaches my mind to think about something that's positive instead of hijacking me with some silly worry. Now, another thing that surprised me about worry is just how subtle it is and how fast it can seize control of you. And I've also been surprised by how often I start to worry the moment that I feel happiness or love. This spring, it happened to me as I was looking at our 17-year-old daughter. You know, I had this incredible moment where my heart just leapt out of my chest. And I felt this tidal wave of love wash over me. And then suddenly, without any warning, all these worries just came galloping into my mind and they stole the moment. And all I felt wasn't love anymore. It was fear. This is what happened. We were at the mall and Sawyer was trying on dresses for her high school prom. And let me tell you, it'd been a long afternoon. I think we were on like our third dress store and she had tried on 40 dresses. She hated every last one of them. And by this point in the day, anytime I said, oh my gosh, you look beautiful, her mood just got even worse. So I was in the dressing room with her and I was picking up the rejects that she was handing to me and I was hanging them back on the hangers and then I'd hand her the next gown to try on and I was kind of starting to panic. I mean, prom was a couple weeks away and I thought, we're never going to find anything at this rate. I mean, this is ridiculous and she's getting worse and worse. And so I handed her another one to try on and said, okay, let's just bang through these next three dresses and let's get out of here. And I stepped out of the dressing room to give her a little bit of space because she was just like a caged bull in that thing. I just not enjoying herself, and I called my husband. And suddenly, I hear her go, Mom, can you come here? Now, I tried to read her voice. I couldn't tell if she was crying, frustrated, if she needed help with some sort of stuck zipper or something, so I cracked open the door to the dressing room. She had on a floor-length gown, and I could see her reflection in the mirror, and I got to tell you, she looked stunning. The dress, it was perfect. It was like this peach color and it had these beautiful flowy side panels that were pink. I mean, it was everything that she wanted. There were no sparkles, no lace. It had an open back. It was a bright color. I mean, it just truly took my breath away seeing her standing there. And her eyes caught in the mirror and she said, well, what do you think, Mom? And I could feel the tears just coming. You know, when she was an infant, I remember experiencing this same tidal wave of emotion that can rush over you when you love someone so much. You know, in the middle of the night, I'd wake up and go in and check on her and she'd be there in her crib. You know, how some kids, they'll sleep on their back and they raise their arms up above her head. And I would stand there alone in her nursery and I'd just stare at her and I'd get hit with this huge tidal wave of love. And I would stand there and marvel how can I love something so much? I mean, it just felt like my heart might burst. And I felt that exact same thing standing outside that dressing room in the mall. I just was so blown away by how much I loved her. And then, without warning, the worries, they just rushed in. They just like, they swept over me. I mean, it just stole the moment without warning. I was now suddenly thinking about her heading off to college and getting married and being a new mom and living far away and time passing and getting older, and suddenly my life is over. And my whole life flashed before my eyes. Suddenly time was racing by. She was getting too old. This was happening too fast. I was losing her. I was so overwhelmed. I was sad. My eyes started to just swell up, not with tears of joy, but I was now afraid. Like, life is cooking. She can't be this old. And Sawyer saw me getting emotional. I mean, here I was just hijacked by worry and fear and, ugh. And she thought I was crying because of the dress. She goes like, oh, Mom, don't cry. You'll make me cry. But she didn't know. I was crying because of how scared I was. I was worried. My life was happening too fast. She was growing up too fast. She was about to move away. I mean, I was going to lose her. I was crying because I just wanted my life to slow down. And you know what? Worry. It robbed me. It robbed me of joy in that moment. Like, it took me away from Sawyer. It took me to this really dark place in my head. So instead of just being present and in awe of my beautiful daughter, all I felt was fear. Yeah, that's how worry and fear hijack your mind. They rob you of the magic and the wonder in your life. They steal you away from the moment. You know, Brené Brown, love her. She observed this exact same phenomenon in her research for her bestseller, Daring Greatly. She found that the feeling, that kind of worst case feeling, that pain that I felt in moments of joy, you know, things like you can't hug your kid without worrying about something bad happening to them. It's amazingly common. Why is it so hard for us to do it? Well, we're trying to beat vulnerability to the punch, is what Dr. Brown says. See, here's what I believe. When your mind takes you somewhere sad, dark, doubtful, or negative, you don't have to go with it. Your mind can drift to worry. You don't have to drift there. I love what Hein wrote to me. Since I saw your first TED Talk, I've come to realize how big an enemy my bad inner voice has been to not only my self-confidence, but more so to my ability to move forward and grow my self-identity. Every decision and turn has been shaded by self-doubt and concerns for what others would think. 99.999% of the time, it has always been fake reality that I had created in my mind. My biggest challenge has and always will be to stop worrying what others think of me. It makes no difference. Thanks for the great motivation. When you find your inner voice becoming the enemy, as Hein did and as I experienced, it's important to stop worrying and recognize that in 5 seconds, yeah, worry can hijack you, but in 5 seconds, you can hijack yourself back. In 5 seconds, worry can steal your thoughts, but in 5 seconds, you can make a decision to not go with it. That's exactly what I did. I could feel how quickly this fear took over. So I started counting. 5, 4, 3, and as I counted, I could feel, and this is going to happen to you, I could feel the fear lowering in my body. You're going to start to, as you use this, you're going to feel how worry, as it has your thoughts to worry, they drift. You're going to feel your mind move, literally, from the thoughts that you're thinking, you're going to feel it drift to the basal ganglia. You're going to feel your mind switching gears as you start to worry. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you're going to yank yourself out of your head, and you're going to plant yourself back in the present moment. I started counting, and it switched the gears from worry about how quickly my life is going to the present. Because I'm going to tell you something. I was not going to let my brain and my habit of worrying, not going to let it rob me of this experience of my daughter. I was not going to let this derail me from being in the moment and being present enough to take a mental photograph so I would remember this. Because I didn't want to remember the worry. I wanted to remember this moment. Then I asked myself two simple questions. What am I grateful for in this moment? What do I want to remember? When you ask that simple question, you impact your brain at a biological level. Because in order to respond, you have to take stock of the moment, your life, relationships, work, get a search for an answer. So when you 5-4-3-2-1 and you awaken your prefrontal cortex and then you just kind of focus yourself on, well, what is it about this moment? It's going to make you see the positive aspects of your life. And as soon as you think about what you're grateful for, you're going to start feeling grateful instead of worried. The answer to the question was clear to me. I was grateful to have such an incredible young woman as my daughter. And after 3 hours of drama at the mall, I was also grateful that we had finally found a dress. Katie also is using the rule to reflect on what she's grateful for and to control her worrying. I saw you in California at a convention. I almost didn't go on that trip. I was riddled with anxiety and guilt leaving my 5-year-old daughter, but I'm also going through a divorce. But then I went and I met you. And you're a huge inspiration to me, and so is the 5-second rule. I used the 5-second rule before I even knew there was one by pushing myself to go. I cried every day while I was away. I'm still using it daily in my life to work out, to not be sad, to be more grateful, and now to hold off on my divorce. Because we just aren't sure, and that's okay. I'm learning that nothing is perfect in life, so thank you. Nothing in life is perfect. Nothing at all. But you can use 5-4-3-2-1 to quiet the mental chatter and learn to appreciate all of the small moments, like feeling grateful for your daughter. Feeling grateful doesn't just feel good. According to neuroscientist Alex Korb, it actually changes your brain chemistry by activating the bloodstem region and produces dopamine. So with my worries gone, I took a deep breath and stepped into the dressing room to move closer to Sawyer, and I put my hand on her shoulder and her eyes met in the mirror. Well, what do you think, Mom? I looked at her and I said, I think Luke is going to have a heart attack. You look absolutely gorgeous. Chapter 13, End Anxiety. Anxiety is what happens when your habit of worrying spirals out of control. As a lifelong anxiety sufferer, I know all too well the grip it can hold on you and how scary it can feel. I also know how to beat it. Using the 5-second rule in combination with a strategy called reframing is the answer. The key to beating anxiety is understanding it. If you can catch it right as it kicks in and reframe it, you'll stabilize your thoughts before your mind escalates it into a full-blown panic. And over time, as you use the 5-second rule over and over, your anxiety will weaken and become what it started out as, simple worries. And as you just learned, the habit of worry is easy to break. I think I was born an anxious child. Because as a kid, my parents said I had a nervous stomach and I worried about everything. I was that kid at camp who was so homesick she had to go home early. As a college student, my face would turn red as a tomato when I got called on in class. I relied on liquid courage to talk to guys at parties because without alcohol, I'd get stress hives on my neck. The panic attack started in my early 20s when I began law school. A panic attack feels like you're about to have a heart attack, and it can happen for two reasons. One, because you have something scary that you've got to do, like give a speech or face an ex or get on an airplane. Or two, for absolutely no reason at all. Now, if you've ever had a panic attack, here's the best way to describe them. It's when your mind and body have a near-miss experience that's totally out of context. Allow me to explain using a really simple analogy. Let's distinguish between normal panic and actual panic attacks. You see, there's going to be tons of time in your life where you panic and it will be completely normal. Let's say you and I are driving a car and we're chatting on the highway and you're about to change lanes. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a car races by, cuts us off, swerves, you get out of the way, oh my God, but they nearly miss us. Woo! When a near miss happens on the highway, what do you feel? You feel a surge of adrenaline race through your body. Your heart races, your breath speeds up, your cortisol surges. Your body goes into this state of like hyper alertness so that you can take control of the car, and you might even get a little sweaty. Now, as soon as your body freaks out, what happens is your mind has to find a reason as to why your body is so agitated. In this example that I just gave you on the highway, your brain realizes, oh my gosh, they almost got into a car crash. That's why your heart is racing. No wonder. And when your mind has an explanation for why your body just freaked out, your mind isn't going to make the anxiety worse. Your mind will allow your body to calm down because your mind knows that the danger has passed. You see, the car almost hit you. It didn't hit you. The car is now gone. There's no reason for you to stay freaked out. Your life can now go back to normal. Now, you're going to be a little bit more cautious the next time you're about to change the lane, but you're not going to continue to be hyperventilating. The danger has passed. Now, when you have a panic attack, on the other hand, that same near-miss experience that we just felt on the highway, it happens to you, but without any warning, and for no reason at all. You could be standing in your kitchen. You're going to pour yourself a cup of coffee. You're about to do your 30 before 7:30 planning session. It's just like any other morning, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, oh my gosh, you have the surge of adrenaline, and your heart starts to race, and suddenly, like, your palms are sweaty, and you start to breathe really heavy, and you don't know why. And unfortunately, there's no car that just about hit you. You're just standing in your kitchen. Your heart races, your breath speeds up, your cortisol surges, your body goes into this state of like hyper awareness. And see, now, what do you know? When your body goes into a state of agitation, what does your mind do? Your mind starts searching for a reason why. If your mind can't figure out why you just had a freak out, you know what it's going to do? It's going to think you're in actual danger. Your mind is going to go completely into protection mode on you. It's going to make that fear worse. And it's going to make you think that danger is imminent because your brain is basically like, holy cow, her heart is racing, her palms are, what the hell is going on? Well, there must be something going on. Last time this happened, we were on the highway and it was a car and that made sense, but this made no sense. You know, this is why, by the way, as your heart's racing and your mind is racing for an explanation so it can make sense of what's happening to your body, this is why your mind starts to say things when you're having a panic attack, like maybe I'm having a heart attack, maybe I don't want to get married, maybe it's my job, maybe I'm going to get fired, maybe I'm dying. If your mind can't find a suitable explanation, your brain is going to make your anxiety worse so that you physically move. It wants you to leave the room. You know, if you've ever seen anybody that you care about have a panic attack, stop and think about what they were like. They started breathing really heavy. Their heart starts fluttering. They start to freak out. They dart around. They have scattered thoughts. They don't know how to calm themselves down. They don't know why they feel so freaked out. They have a deer in the headlights look. Then suddenly they'll say, I just have to get out of here. I just have to get out of here. That's their brain. Their brain can't explain what's happening, so their brain wants to protect them. It's actually making it worse so that they will move out of the room. It's a vicious cycle, and it's something I was trapped in for years. Now, for a long time, I understood neither the difference between normal panic and actual panic attacks, nor did I understand the role that my mind was playing in escalating the anxiety. I went to therapists. I tried all kinds of cognitive techniques to try to stop myself from panicking. It got so bad, the panic attacks, that I actually became afraid of having panic attacks. And that fear, of course, just made me have more panic attacks. Finally, what happened for me is I went and got professional help. I got myself on Zoloft with the help of a psychiatrist, and it was a miracle for me, truly. It literally was like taking, you know, the volume on a stereo and turning it to zero. I felt like myself again. And here's the deal. I took it for 2 decades. And as far as I'm concerned, zero stigma on mental health. I look at mental health issues like diabetes. When you have diabetes, your body cannot process insulin or doesn't make enough of it. When you have mental health issues, you also have a chemical imbalance. Therapy plus drugs can be absolutely amazing, and you should explore it. So here's the thing, though. I was the kind of person where I just thought, oh, I'll just take Zoloft for the rest of my life. And then what happened is we had kids, and all three of our kids started to struggle with their own form of anxieties. And it was beyond mere worrying. The anxiety was impacting their lives. They stopped doing sleepovers. They would sleep on the floor of our bedroom. They were worried about everything. Oakley named his panic Oliver. Anytime he started getting a panic attack, Oliver's here. And our daughter Sawyer, she would call it her what if loop. She would get stuck in this. Well, what if this happens? And what if that happens? She said, you know, it's like there's this what if loop, Mom. Once I start thinking about all the what ifs, I get stuck thinking about what all the what ifs. And if I can't get out of it because there are always what ifs. Sounds like a Shel Silverstein poem, doesn't it? You know, I knew how scary it was to suffer from it. And it was heartbreaking to see our kids struggling and afraid. It was really eye-opening and frustrating trying to help them deal with their anxiety because nothing worked. We would go to specialists after specialists after specialists. We tried all kinds of techniques and games. We set up prizes for them to face their fears. And honestly, it just seemed to keep getting worse. So I came off Zoloft to face my own anxiety head on, because I wanted to better understand it and figure out how to beat it so I could help our kids figure out how to beat theirs. Here's what I learned. First of all, telling somebody to try to calm down, it does not work. It actually makes it worse. I've spent countless hours with therapists who have told me and the kids, just change the channel, think about something else. That works if you're worried. It works if you're worried. But as a strategy for full-blown anxiety, it doesn't work. See, when you're worried about something, your thoughts have drifted, but your heart isn't racing yet. So your thoughts drift, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, awaken your prefrontal cortex. Your mind is now ready to receive a new thought, insert a new thought. That's how you control worry. That's how you change your attitude. That's how you create a new mindset. Very straightforward. When you're having anxiety, what happens is you are worried and now your body is starting to get agitated. Your heart is racing. Your palms are sweating because of what you're thinking. And when you are in a state of physical agitation, it's impossible to get somebody to calm down. And in fact, it's like asking somebody to go from 60 miles an hour to 0 miles an hour. It's a lot like trying to make a freight train stop by throwing a boulder in front of it. It's going to jump the tracks. There was actually a study in the Journal of Behavior Research and Therapy that showed when you try to make somebody calm down and you tell them, just stop thinking about that thing that's worrying you, guess what happens? They end up getting more upset. When you try to tell yourself to calm down, you make the anxiety worse because you're fighting against it. When you understand how panic works, what it is, the role your brain has in making it worse, you can beat it by working with it. There are two strategies that work really well together. One is the 5-second rule. Use it first because that's going to assert control over your mind. It's going to interrupt the default setting of anxiety, and it's going to cue your prefrontal cortex to pay attention. And then what we're going to do is we're going to teach you how to reframe the anxiety as excitement. As excitement. I'm going to say that again because I don't want your brain to escalate what you're feeling. I want your brain to be like, oh, that makes sense. And that'll then allow your body to calm down. Here's how you're going to do it. Excitement and anxiety feel the exact same in your body. Okay? I'm going to explain this to you. So I first used this strategy of reframing anxiety as excitement when I started in public speaking. I get a lot of questions about public speaking and specifically how do you get over your fears and nerves about public speaking? And my answer always surprises people. My answer is this. I have never gotten over my fears and my nerves. I just use them to my advantage. Now, here's what may surprise you about that answer. I speak for a living. As in a lot. In 2016, I was not only one of the most booked speakers in the world, I was the most booked female speaker in America. 103 keynotes in 1 year. Biggest audience, over 20,000 people. Absolutely amazing. Do I get nervous? Absolutely I do. Every single time. But here's the trick. And this is what I'm going to teach you to do. I don't call it nerves. I call it excitement. And that is a game changer. And the reason why it works with anxiety is because physiologically, anxiety, excitement, exact same thing. Nervousness, excitement, exact same thing. Fear and excitement are the same thing to your body. The only difference between excitement and anxiety is what your mind calls the sensation. It's like the near miss example. Remember when you were on the highway and a car almost hits you and your heart starts to race and you freak out for a second and then the car passes and the danger is gone and you're like, oh, okay, the danger has passed. Whew, deep breath, we're okay. But if that same physical sensation happens in your kitchen, it's exactly the same. There's no danger. The only difference is your mind doesn't have a logical reason to explain it, so your mind makes it worse. We're going to use that same principle with an anxiety. If your brain has a good explanation for why your body is freaking out, it won't make it worse. This is the key to beating anxiety. This is it right here. Understanding that if you can give your mind a reason why you're upset, why your body's freaking out, you can beat it. So the first time I ever gave a legitimate speech, like no joke, the first time I walked onto a stage and gave an actual speech was when I gave that TEDx talk in San Francisco in 2011. I remember standing backstage listening to one person with a PhD after one person with a PhD give their talks. And you know what I was thinking to myself for 7 hours straight? This is the dumbest thing I have ever gotten myself into. I am about to go out there and tell these people that I am a local radio host who dreams of being as big as Rush Limbaugh. I'm nowhere near doing that. I am going to make a complete and utter ass of myself. You know what was happening for me backstage? My palms were sweaty. My heart was racing. I was convinced I was going to be the stupidest person with the dumbest speech, that I was going to look like a total moron after all these people, that I was going to have a bright red face, that I was going to get laughed off that stage. My face was hot. My armpits were dripping like Niagara Falls. You know what my body was doing? It was prepping for action. I was getting ready to do something. And I kept telling myself, oh my God, I'm nervous. Oh my gosh, this is going to be terrible. I labeled all these sensations that I was feeling. The sweaty pits, the clammy palms, the beating heart, as a warning sign that this was going to go horrible. I said I was nervous. You want to know something wild? So it's 6 years later. 6 years later. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of speeches later. Do you know I still feel the exact same thing in my body when I'm backstage? The exact same thing. My palms sweat. My heart races. My face gets hot. My armpits start to drip. Physiologically, I am in a state of arousal. My body is preparing to go out on stage. And here's the difference, though. I just call it excitement. It's the exact same freaking feeling I felt 6 years ago. I just called it nerves. I channel it in a positive direction. If I were to go backstage and say, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm nervous, 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 I'll tell you what, I would get more nervous. What your brain calls what your body's doing is the secret. Now, the more speeches that I give, the more comfortable and confident I become about what I'm saying. But even as I've gained confidence in my abilities, I've noticed that the feelings in my body, they don't disappear. That's when it dawned on me that maybe this is just my body's way to get ready to do something cool. And so I started telling myself that I was getting excited instead of calling it nervousness, and everything changed. My body still gets agitated, but I don't freak out ever. Now look, I never knew that my little trick of relabeling it something else from nervousness to excitement has some serious ass science behind it. It's called anxiety reappraisal. Reframing your anxiety as excitement works. Not just for me, it has worked in study after study after study. Harvard Business School professor Allison Wood Brooks just conducted this massive study where she would tell people before they were about to do something that made them nervous to reframe it and say out loud, I'm excited. I'm excited. I know it sounds really stupid. I actually stand backstage and go, I'm excited. I'm excited. I'm excited. And it works. I get really excited and I don't freak out. And what she found is not only does the strategy of going 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm excited. Not only does it work to not have you freak out, guess what? You perform better. In study after study after study, kids that would say I'm excited before walking into a math test, guess what? They did better than the kids who didn't. People that said I'm excited before they walked into an interview or a negotiation for a raise did better than the people that didn't. People that stood at a track meet and before they ran said, I'm excited, I'm excited. People that did karaoke, I'm excited, did better than the people who don't. The question is why? The reason is simple. Anxiety is a state of arousal. It is so much easier to convince your brain that all those arousal feelings are natural and they're just excitement than trying to calm yourself down. Reframing your nervousness into enthusiasm works, not just in research at Harvard. Susie used this right after she learned the 5-second rule. Here's what she wrote to me. My husband and I are planning to get out of our comfort spot in a big way. He's going to retire soon, and we are looking into moving across the country to the East Coast. Every time I get, quote, that feeling in my stomach, you know the one, fear of change, I remember the 5-second rule and saying, I'm excited. I make a list of stuff I have to do. I check them off one by one. It's taking us a little closer to our dream. Thank you for the inspiration. She's using it to stop that, quote, feeling in her stomach from growing into something that stops her. Now, here's the catch. When you tell yourself, I'm excited, it doesn't lower the feelings in your body. Your heart rate's not going to disappear. Your palms are still going to be a little sweaty. You might feel parched in your throat. Whatever the feelings that you used to call nervousness, they're going to stay there. But what happens is really important. They don't get bigger. They don't escalate. When you say, I'm excited, you stay in control. And your brain stops worrying about it, which gives your body a chance to start to calm itself down. So the next time that you feel yourself getting worried, or you feel nervousness or panic starting to set in while you're making a cup of coffee, or you're experiencing a little bit of stage fright or pregame jitters, or you're worried about a big exam or a job interview, I want you to try this. Use the 5-second rule and this new research to beat it to the punch. As soon as you feel the physical sensations start to tick up, you get that feeling in your stomach, you feel your heart start to rate, you start pacing a little bit. That's a moment. I want you to take control. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You're going to seize the moment. Then I want you to start telling yourself, I'm so excited. I'm so excited to play this game. I'm so excited to make this cup of coffee. I'm so excited to be on this plane. I'm so excited to take this test. That's exactly what Greg did when he reframed his feelings in order to beat anxiety. I have reframed this hesitation as an opportunity to get going on my work in those 5 seconds, even though I don't feel like it. I have allowed this not feeling like it to become a full-blown anxiety disorder. And I truly think that this technique has helped me find a way to get unstuck. So thank you for helping me reframe these feelings of never feeling like it from normal rather than neurotic. See, the physical impact of 5-4-3-2-1, which is the first action, and then saying you're excited is critical because it's you exerting yourself. It's awakening your prefrontal cortex, and it allows you to start focusing on the positive explanation. Look, when you first start using this strategy, you might have to repeat it 27 times in 1 hour. The first time our 11-year-old used it to beat his anxiety about sleepovers, he said, "I'm excited to sleep over at Quinn's house," over and over and over again during a 6-mile drive from our house to Quinn's, bless his little heart, over and over. "I'm excited to sleep over at Quinn's house. How you feeling, Oak?" My stomach is grumbling, so I must be excited because I'm going to Quinn's house to sleep over. So when we finally get to Quinn's house, we pull into the driveway. I put the car in park and I turn and I say, "How you doing?" And he looked at me and he said, "My heart is still racing and my stomach feels funny, but I'm actually excited to sleep over." That was 6 months ago. His anxiety about sleepovers? Gone. Now he's actually excited. And that's the power of this tool. It truly works. Chapter 14, Beat Fear. Fear will make you do some nutty things. One of my greatest fears in life used to be dying in a fiery plane crash. When I had to get on a plane, I used to be a total weirdo. I had all these superstitions about flying. First, I would scan the boarding area looking for women with small babies, men or women in uniform, priests, nuns, wheelchairs, off-duty pilots catching a ride home, or just generally kind-looking people. Then I would tell myself, "All right, God's not going to let the plane go down with these nice folks on board. You're okay, Mel." That would assuage me to get on the plane. But then once I was on the plane, every single bump or little sound the plane made as we taxied out on the runway, my heart and my chest, it was like up in my throat. Takeoff was the worst. By the time the wheels left the tarmac, I was usually in a full state of panic. I would close my eyes and visualize an explosion, terrorists, my row getting sucked right out of that plane, or the plane just dropping from the sky. I would squeeze that armrest, close my eyes, and barely breathe. Now, once the captain came on, I'd feel a little bit better, but I wouldn't really relax until the seatbelt lights turned off, which was my sign that the pilots believed that we were no longer going to die, that we could actually get up and move. Now, I cured myself of the fear of flying using the 5-second rule and a specific form of anxiety reappraisal that I call anchor thoughts. And you can use the rule the exact same way with any fear. Zahara actually did this with her fear of flying, and it worked. Zahara wrote, "I could so relate to your anxieties about flying that you shared in San Diego. I thought I was the only one who dreaded that their seat was going to be blown out of the airplane by accident. I finally stopped watching Air Crash Investigator and Seconds Before Disaster for this reason. My friend's advice in 2011 and your 5-second rule helped." And then a friend asked her, "Are you flying again?" And she said, "Yes, I already have. I tried the 5-second rule this time, and it worked." Here's how you're going to use the same technique that I spoke to Zahara about. First of all, you're going to create an anchor thought, okay? This is going to set you up for success before you step into a situation that you know you're afraid of. So before I go on any trip, I come up with an anchor thought. This is a thought that is relevant to the trip that I'm taking, that will anchor me if fear sets in. So I start by thinking about the trip. Where am I flying to? What am I excited to do when I get there? If I'm heading to see our friends in Driggs, Idaho, my anchor thought might be climbing up Tabletop Mountain. If I'm traveling home to Michigan, where my parents are, I might think about the moment we pull into the driveway of my parents' house and my kids run out of the car and hug my folks, or maybe taking a nice long walk on Lake Michigan with my mom. If I'm heading to a meeting in Chicago, I'll think about getting an awesome dinner with a client and, you know, maybe ordering a steak or some kind of awesome fish that I'd never cook at home kind of thing. Once I have a specific image in my mind, the rest is really easy. This use of the 5-second rule is a form of what researchers call if-then planning. It's a way to keep yourself in control by creating a backup plan in advance. Plan A don't get nervous. But if I get on the plane and I start to panic or feel afraid, then I have my plan B. I'll use the 5-second rule and my anchor thought to beat my fear of flying. And studies show that this kind of if-then planning can boost your success rates almost 3 times. Now, when I'm on the plane, the moment that I notice something that makes me nervous, whether that be an alarming sound, turbulence, a climb that suddenly seems to be taking too long, you know when you go on takeoff and you're like just soaring, then all of a sudden they pull the engines back and it feels like the plane's about to go in reverse, and you're like, what just happened? That's usually a moment for me where I might do it. The weather looks ominous, or you get this bad vibe from somebody, whatever it may be that triggers your pattern of thinking. When it happens, the moment you notice you're nervous, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, that is going to distract you from your fear. You're going to assert control. You're going to activate your prefrontal cortex, and it's also going to anchor you in the present moment. Then insert the anchor thought, the specific image of where you're flying to, and think about how excited you're going to be when you're walking on Lake Michigan with your mom, or having that delicious dinner in Chicago, or reaching the top of Tabletop Mountain with your buddies. These anchoring images are powerful reminders to your brain. If I'm sitting in a restaurant in Chicago having dinner with my client, or walking the shore of Lake Michigan tomorrow with my mom, or I'm arriving home in time to make the girls' lacrosse game, obviously the plane doesn't crash. I have nothing to worry about. Most important, I give my mind the context it's looking for. That way it doesn't escalate the fear. As I think about this anchor thought, my body calms down. Now, it's important to come up with it before you get on a plane. In the beginning, you know, as you use this, you're going to get better and better at it, and you can create anchor thoughts on the fly. But you want to walk onto a plane or walk into a situation that makes you nervous with a pre-planned anchor thought. The reason being, as soon as you get nervous, it's easy to have that escalate. If you haven't thought of something to go to, your mind might start to race about something to think about, and you could easily lose that mental battle. That's why I want you to have something that's pre-planned. By using this technique over and over again, I have literally cured myself of my fear of flying. And by using, I mean using it over and over. It will get easier and easier until suddenly you're not going to even be afraid anymore. You'll have retrained your mind to default to the positive excitement about what you're about to do instead of the fear of experiencing flying in the moment. Dana was able to use this technique successfully, and she's never been so calm when she's flown. Listen to what she had to say. I loved watching you at the convention. I used your 5-4-3-2-1 method on the plane yesterday, and it worked. I don't think I've ever been so calm when flying. Thank you. Your words were inspirational and uplifting. And Fran put it to use on the flight home immediately after learning the technique at a conference in Dallas. Hi, I have a story to tell you. I've always hated flying and avoid it. This year, the convention was in Dallas, and since we live in Maryland, we had to fly. I was on the verge of a panic attack the entire flight. I was so upset that I got in other people's nerves. Fast forward to you speaking. Oh my gosh, it made a world of difference flying home. Every time I felt the panic, I used your 5-second rule, and halfway through the flight, I was looking out the window, taking pictures. I cannot believe how much I was missing by being afraid. That was proof enough for me, and it's worked in other areas as well. I love what Fran said at the end of her note. I can't believe how much I was missing by being afraid. She's right, and it's heartbreaking. I realized the same thing. I was robbing myself of joy, opportunity, and magic every single day because I was living with fear. It doesn't have to be that way. In 5 seconds flat, you can take control. You can beat fear. You know, today I'm never nervous or afraid when I board a plane. Occasionally, if we hit a rough turbulence or something, I'll break out the rule so that I don't drive my fingernails into the arm of the person sitting next to me. However, I still use this technique when I face other fears, before a negotiation or a very difficult conversation, for example. If I feel myself getting nervous, I'll create an anchor thought of the conversation or the negotiation going really well. Specifically, I might picture somebody hugging me or thanking me for, quote, having the conversation.